Good evening. I'm John Gussett for the Virginia Voice, reading from the current issues of Forbes, Fortune, and Barron's magazines. We'll begin by reading from the April-May edition of Forbes magazine. Our first article is titled, How to Get a Truly Green World, by Steve Forbes, Editor-in-Chief. The world is in sorry shape economically. It's heresy to say it, but one exceedingly productive move that would make the global economy great again would be to take a chainsaw to the immensely wasteful spending on so-called renewables, primarily windmills and solar panels. This would free up money for productive investment to fuel desperately needed economic growth. Such a big initiative is needed. The World Bank's estimate for global growth in 2024 is only 2.4%. This after a pathetic 2.6% last year. And that 2.4% may prove too optimistic. Post-COVID economies should be surging. Instead, most are treading water or sinking. Developing countries are languishing. China says it will expand 5% in 2024. But no one believes Beijing's numbers anymore, not with the huge unemployment among young people and a still troubled property market, once a major engine of growth. Germany, Japan, and Britain are in recession or close to it. President Biden boasts that the United States has the best economy in the world, but our performance is substandard by historic standards and unhealthily buttressed by big government spending. Amazingly, given the strange way we calculate GDP, government spending directly boosts it. The more checks Uncle Sam sends out, the higher the GDP number. Washington will shovel out about $7 trillion this financial year, and Biden wants to spend even more next year. These annual outlays exceed the supposed temporary highs during the worst of the COVID crisis. In other words, our subpar performance rests on a destructive, anti-productive investment platform. Countries are drowning in debt. Total debt worldwide is $300 trillion, almost three times the size of the global economy. Slashing spending on alternative energy sources would set loose enormous sums of money to get economies expanding again. This is particularly crucial for poorer nations facing politically toxic stagnation. Renewables are supposed to save the planet by eliminating carbon dioxide emissions, but more and more evidence points to the fact that the massive amounts of minerals needed for such a switch and other environmentally damaging steps in the process end up, at best, a draw with fossil fuels. In other words, we're wasting unimaginable amounts of money for nothing. Consider this. In this century, we've spent almost $6 trillion on renewables, and the share of energy worldwide coming from fossil fuels has declined from 86% to only 84%. If all these resources had instead gone into producing new businesses, expanding existing ones, creating new life-enhancing technologies, and ensuring safe water for everyone, imagine how much better off the world would be. Or ponder this. Incredibly, Europe's carbon dioxide emissions peaked in 1979. Those of the U.S. peaked in 2005. There are two surefire clean sources of energy, natural gas and nuclear power. Yet the Biden administration is throttling the output of natural gas, even though the U.S. is loaded with it. Simultaneously, regulators are stifling exciting advances in nuclear energy, most specifically small modular reactors, SMRs, which are much easier to construct and save considerable time and cost. SMRs can supply power to compact areas like towns, campuses, hospitals, and data centers. But government regulations are smothering SMRs by adding immense and unnecessary expenses and delays. Bad, untimely, and ultimately insulting advice. U.S. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer recently made a shameful speech targeting Israel. What he did was deeply disturbing for our security, and it's symptomatic of how the U.S. government is both morally unmoored, It's ready to betray a democratic country today, the way the West did to Czechoslovakia in 1938, and extraordinarily derelict in the face of a world that has become as dangerous as it was in the 1930s, which led to World War II. The White House, in fact, wants to cut military spending in real terms. Senator Schumer delivered what amounted to an ultimatum to the Democratic State of Israel. Do what I and the Biden administration order, or else. The implication being that Jerusalem would see slowdowns or cutoffs of aid and military equipment if the Israelis didn't carry out what was being required of them. Schumer declared that Israel should hold new elections once the war starts to wind down, replacing the unity government headed by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu with one more amenable to how Schumer and President Biden think things should be done. How condescending. Israel is a vibrant democracy that will hold elections as it sees proper. Israel is fighting for its existence. Iran and its proxies, like Hamas, are clear that they want Israel eradicated. Hamas's deliberate, meticulously planned atrocities committed during its October 7th invasion graphically demonstrated that nothing less than a second Holocaust will suffice. Urban warfare, in contrast to fighting on open battlefields, is difficult to prosecute. Hamas is fighting with the express purpose of maximizing civilian casualties to generate international pressure on Israel to pull back. The civilian suffering is grievous as Hamas hobbles straightforward assistance that is not under its control. Perhaps the Israelis could do more without jeopardizing their forces, but Israel gets little credit for the extraordinary efforts it has already made to minimize civilian casualties. Hamas's murderous strategy is working with this White House and fair-weather friends like Chuck Schumer. President Biden has warned Israel not to wage its planned offensive in the city of Rafah, the last stronghold of Hamas. Letting Hamas survive as a force that controls a real base of operations in Gaza would be a huge win for both Hamas and Iran. The Ayatollahs could say that if Israel can't eliminate Hamas, it stands no chance of ultimate survival, given all the other growing forces arrayed against it. Anti-Iranian Arab states would get the message. Iran is in charge of the Middle East now. That Senator Schumer would advocate an approach that saves Hamas from elimination is beyond understanding. After all, as he said in his speech, his surname is derived from the Hebrew word Shomer, which means guardian. Schumer also declared that Israel must accept a two-state solution for the Palestinian situation. This decades-old idea is always a non-starter because Palestinian leaders won't accept the existence of Israel. After all, Israel withdrew unconditionally from Gaza almost 20 years ago. What happened next? Hamas, with its uncompromising platform to wipe Israel off the map, was voted into power. Israel doesn't need Senator Schumer's ill-timed, utterly counterproductive kibitzing. That article was titled How to Get a Truly Green World and Bad, Untimely, and Ultimately Insulting Advice by Steve Forbes, Editor-in-Chief. Our next article from the April-May edition of Forbes magazine is titled The New Gold Standard. Jorge Mas took a risk with a lucrative bet on Lionel Messi and quickly transformed Inter Miami into the MLS's second billion-dollar franchise. But now the clock is ticking. By Justin Birnbaum. Inside the Aquadome, a spherical atrium on the largest cruise ship in the world, Jorge Mas settles into his seat for what promises to be an extravagant show. Inter Miami's billionaire owner is aboard Royal Caribbean's Icon of the Seas to unveil his Major League Soccer Club's record-setting jersey sponsorship with the cruise company and witness the vessel's naming ceremony. He looks on as the talent takes the stage, including an award-winning Scottish cover band, aquatic acrobats, and the day's biggest draw, Argentine soccer star Lionel Messi. For Inter Miami, such fanfare was once unfathomable. 10 months ago, it was the last place club in American professional soccer's highest tier, valued just above league average at $600 million, with minimal global fame, despite being partly owned by David Beckham. Now you have to be under a rock to not know that Lionel Messi plays at Inter Miami, the 61-year-old Moss says. Securing Messi didn't come cheap, even if his Inter Miami salary is far less than the reported $400 million a year offer the Argentine star spurned from the Saudi Pro League. Moss says Messi will earn between $50 million and $60 million in guaranteed money annually, with the potential for more through individual revenue sharing deals with Apple and Adidas. Messi also has an option to take ownership in the club, which does not require a buy-in if exercised. But the South Florida-based franchise has already proven the reward was more than worthy of the financial risk. In 2023, with just a half season of Messi, Inter Miami more than doubled its revenue to $118 million. The club expects that to soar past $200 million this year, thanks to Messi-fueled ticket sales, lucrative advertising partnerships, and an unprecedented global preseason tour. Messi's arrival also doubled subscriptions last year on the league's Apple TV streaming service, and teams hosting Inter Miami scored massive gate revenue increases. Forbes estimates Inter Miami is now the second most valuable club in MLS, at just over $1 billion, and Moss's roughly 80% stake has boosted his already sizable fortune to $1.7 billion. Inter Miami's dramatic rise is the result of Moss's unwavering, once irrational belief that he would eventually land the 8-time Ballon d'Or winner. But as much as Messi's arrival opened a window of opportunity for his team, Moss is faced with an immediate challenge. The 36-year-old Messi can't play forever, and his inevitable departure threatens to undo Inter Miami's progress. We understand the opportunity ahead of us, Moss says. We need to make sure that we keep fans, Messi or no Messi. In retrospect, Moss is an unlikely architect of, arguably, the most significant deal in U.S. soccer history, considering the sport was hardly his first love. The Miami native and son of Cuban refugees grew up a baseball fanatic and aspired to play in college before Moss says a knee injury derailed his dream. Instead, he studied business at the University of Miami and later joined his father, Jorge Moss Canosa, a legendary leader in the Cuban exile community, at his family's construction company. The younger Moss ushered in an evolutionary period for the firm, bringing in computers and automating its billing systems. When Hurricane Andrew decimated South Florida in 1992, he seized the opportunity to rebuild the state's infrastructure. It laid the groundwork for a revenue merger that created MossTech in 1994. Today, the NYSE-traded firm generates $12 billion in revenue annually. Like many ultra-rich sports fans, Moss often fantasized about owning a team. The holy grail would have been being the owner of the NFL's Miami Dolphins, but life has taken me where it should, he says. His moment came in 2018 following an unsuccessful bid to buy MLB's Miami Marlins. MLS Commissioner Don Garber cold-called Moss, seeking a local partner to join Beckham in bringing an expansion team to South Florida. He mulled the offer, knowing it would be a risky investment, as most MLS clubs have traditionally lost money. However, after meeting with the former England captain and discussing their shared vision, Moss agreed to join the new ownership group. I knew that he had enormous passion for our sport, loves his city, and had a grand vision for what MLS in Miami could be, Garber says. So it was kind of love at first sight. Even before Inter Miami debuted in 2020, Moss aimed to attract the best players in the world. He started meeting with Messi's agent and father, Jorge Messi, in September 2019. His pursuit took him through Rosario, Argentina, Doha, Qatar, Barcelona, and Paris, as rumors surged that the Argentine would remain in Europe or decamp to Saudi Arabia. Mas's tenacity was rewarded last June when Messi announced his next destination, creating a surge of fandom in South Florida. More people feel connected to our city or want to be connected with our city in a deeper way, says Craig Robbins, a prominent Miami real estate developer. Miami became a soccer city. But Messi's limitations have already become apparent. In October, the Chicago Fire drew 62,124 fans to Soldier Field to see MLS's newest superstar, only for him to be ruled out due to injury minutes before kickoff. He also sat out the sold-out Hong Kong leg of the club's preseason tour in February, drawing intense criticism from disappointed fans. A packed 2024 competition schedule only increases the urgency for Mas to plot his franchise's future beyond Messi. When Messi will hang up his MLS cleats is unclear. He's under contract for 2024 and 2025, with an option for 2026, and Mas is highly confident his star will stay the additional year, even though he'll be pushing 40. Either way, it shouldn't affect Inter Miami's partnership revenue in the short term. Mas planned for many of the club's deals to expire around Messi's arrival, so it could sign more lucrative ones, which he says will last well beyond the star's tenure. In the past few months, Inter Miami has added multi-year packs with J.P. Morgan Chase and Duracell, in addition to the deal with Royal Caribbean. Just as Pele joining the Cosmos in 1975 brought other international soccer stars to New York, Mas is banking Inter Miami's future on its ability to draw other top players to his team. Money is no consideration, he says, and Miami does have certain advantages: warm weather, cultural appeal, no state income tax, and proximity to home for Latin and South American players. By 2027, Mas expects MLS will have between 12 to 20 of the top 100 players in the world. It's a crucial time, too, as the league hopes to capitalize on the 2026 World Cup, which will be held in 16 cities across North America. Its media deal with Apple could be the most critical element. At an undisclosed subscriber threshold, the tech giant will share revenue with MLS beyond the $2.5 billion guaranteed over 10 years. I feel a responsibility to help the league first, Mas says. This wasn't only an Inter Miami thing, it's a league-wide thing. I'll continue pushing as hard as I can for the overall benefit and health and growth of the league. That article was titled "The New Gold Standard" by Justin Birnbaum. Our next article is from the April-May edition of Fortune magazine and is titled "A Defining Decision for Leaders" by Allison Chantel, Editor-in-Chief, Fortune magazine. What is the definition of success? Is it measured by the amount of money you make, the title on your office door, the positive impact you have on others? Whatever your definition, it dictates everything in your life, from who you marry to your career ambitions. The same goes for companies. Whichever success metric a CEO emphasizes, revenue growth, efficiency, culture, social impact, it's felt throughout the entire organization, even down to customers. Take Cisco, for example. 9 years ago, when Chuck Robbins became CEO, he scribbled down a goal on a piece of paper: make this the best place to work. He spent the next few years engaging with employees at monthly all-hands meetings and being an open book. I'll answer any question as long as it doesn't violate laws or land me in jail, Robbins joked at a recent Fortune dinner. If it lands one of my executives in jail, okay, we can still talk about it. Under his leadership, Cisco has shot up the ranks of Fortune's annual 100 Best Companies to Work For list, going from number 82 in 2016 to number 2 this year. Cisco held the top spot for the past 3 years, but Hilton just knocked it off its perch. At aerospace giant Boeing, big choices made decades ago are having devastating ripple effects today. Beginning in the late 1990s, Boeing's leadership team decided to change the emphasis of what had been an engineering-first culture, putting the focus on maximizing earnings instead. This redefinition of success led Boeing to change how its planes were manufactured. More work that was previously done in-house was sent to third-party contractors, making the assembly process harder to oversee, but cheaper, and everybody in the supply chain was pressured to slash costs. For a while, the strategy seemed to work, and the stock soared. Now it's clear the cost-cutting also helped cause Boeing's quality control to deteriorate, which has led to a series of disasters for the company and its customers and passengers. Fortune's Sean Tully provides the details behind Boeing's breakdown, including the final days of a whistleblower who was recently found dead in a hotel parking lot. In this issue, you'll also find a deep dive into Saudi Aramco, as Vivian Walt explores how the most profitable company on the planet, which last year raked in $13 million in earnings every hour, is helping the Saudi monarchy shake up the global economy. And Michael Levram spent time with Michael Dell, whose computer and server juggernaut turns 40 this year. Dell is the longest-standing founder CEO in big tech, quite a jump for a guy who famously launched Dell from his dorm room as a company called PCs Limited. His definition of success? It involves listening to your customers to figure out where the next big opportunity will come from and being nimble enough to meet it. We hope Fortune helps you define success the right way and reach it once you've defined it. That article was titled A Defining Decision for Leaders by Allison Chantel, Editor-in-Chief, Fortune Magazine. Our next articles are also from the April-May edition of Fortune Magazine. The title of this article, Today Chips, Tomorrow Everything. Why the CHIPS Act is Rewriting the Rules for Every Big American Business, by Jeff Colvin. The United States, where computer chips were invented, hasn't manufactured leading-edge chips since 2017. From then until now, the world's fastest, most valuable chips, the kind that power OpenAI's ChatGPT, Apple's newest iPhones, and the world's biggest supercomputers, have been made only in Taiwan and South Korea. But sometime next year, if all goes as planned, the U.S. will reclaim global leadership when Intel starts producing in volume a next-generation chip in the U.S. The chip technology, which Microsoft has already committed to use as the foundation for Intel-made proprietary chips, probably won't be fully matched elsewhere for at least many months. The dramatic turnaround owes much to the CHIPS and Science Act, which was signed into law in 2022 to revive semiconductor manufacturing in the U.S. Some $52 billion in grants is being dispersed to companies led by Intel. Subject to reaching milestones in coming years, Intel could receive a grant of up to $8.5 billion, plus up to $11 billion in government loans, and a 25% tax credit on a planned $100 billion in investment. A senior administration official said Intel's package of subsidies would likely be the largest in the program. Commerce Secretary Gina Raimondo, who oversees most of the program, explains its rationale succinctly. We cannot allow ourselves to be overly reliant on one part of the world for the most important piece of hardware in the 21st century. The CHIPS Act is significant for companies beyond the tech industry. With $280 billion in total authorized funding, most of it not yet spent, it's an enormous exercise of industrial policy, government support of a specific industry. Widespreading ripple effects could help or hinder businesses across the economy. For example, local businesses in cities with large projects, such as Phoenix or New Albany, Ohio, may boom, while companies in almost any industry nationwide could face stiffer competition for tech-literate employees. More broadly, the CHIPS Act may presage a new era for a range of companies, pushing them into an unfamiliar geopolitical role. The semiconductor industry leads the trend because no modern economy or military can exist without semiconductors. And the more advanced the chips, the more dominant the economy and its military can be. Lazard CEO Peter Orszag and two colleagues, all with deep government experience, describe the larger picture in the latest issue of Foreign Affairs. Nations today contend mainly through economic competition, they say. As a result, a tectonic shift is taking place, one that is forcing corporations to become actors on the geopolitical stage. Citing examples including the CHIPS Act, they say corporations have increasingly become both the objects and instruments of foreign policy. Few CEOs or directors signed up for that. America owned the semiconductor industry after Texas Instruments and Fairchild Semiconductors separately invented the chip in the late 1950s. But the technology's worldwide spread was inevitable. In 1990, the U.S. had 37% of global chip manufacturing capacity, more than any other country, says Boston Consulting Group research. Taiwan, South Korea, and China had none. By 2020, the picture had reversed. Taiwan had the most of any market, 22%, followed by South Korea, 21%, and China, 15%. The U.S. had 12%. Several factors contributed to America's relative decline, including a series of missteps in the 2000s at Intel, the largest U.S. chipmaker then and now. But the main factor was long-running generous government support of chipmakers in all three of the economies that now dominate the industry. For many years, that didn't seem like a problem. In the era of globalization, Western companies happily bought high-quality, competitively priced chips from China's SMIC, South Korea's Samsung, and SK Hynix, and Taiwan's TSMC, among others. As those companies advanced steadily, fueled by subsidies, U.S. competitors couldn't keep up. Look at Taiwan and its manufacturing preeminence, says Brandon Kulik, a principal at Deloitte Consulting. You don't get the scale and the innovation you need without the government being a partner. The threat to the U.S. became apparent in the 2010s. The CHIPS Act was introduced in Congress in 2020, but might never have passed if not for the pandemic. These were lots of chip shortages, and people couldn't buy refrigerators or toasters or cars, says John Neufer, CEO of the Semiconductor Industry Association, SIA, which pushed hard for the CHIPS Act. Without that, we wouldn't have had the public wind in our sails to achieve this historic piece of legislation. Today, the SIA counts 82 projects announced by dozens of companies since the CHIPS Act was introduced. Planned investments total $257 billion in 25 states. Companies planned these investments without knowing if they would get a grant. The larger and more reliable incentive has been the 25% investment tax credit. It's hugely important, says a lobbyist. Without that, if it was just the grants, this wasn't going to work. We wouldn't have had this explosion of investment. Will the CHIPS Act make a case for more industrial policy in other industries? It will subsidize some of the American companies' most formidable competitors, which are already subsidized at home. TSMC is planning two new fabrication plants in Arizona at a cost of $40 billion, one of the largest foreign direct investments in U.S. history. And Samsung plans a $17.3 billion fab in Texas. The CHIPS Act also will not render the U.S. chip industry self-reliant. Making chips is one of the most complex industrial processes in the world, and specialized inputs such as high-precision machines and ultra-pure chemicals are produced only in other countries and probably will be for years. Nor will everything go smoothly. Both of TSMC's new fabs are behind schedule, largely because the company can't find enough workers with the required skills, Chairman Mark Liu has said. Announcements of grants for major chipmakers with projects didn't begin until mid-March, 19 months after the CHIPS Act became law. Still, the program will likely be able to claim credit for putting the U.S. back in the industry's forefront. Intel CEO Pat Gelsinger says the company is on schedule to produce next year that next-generation chip that no other company has been able to make. It will initially be made at Intel's research facility in Oregon. Full-scale production will move to a new CHIPS Act subsidized fab in Chandler, Arizona. In the long term, the CHIPS Act will be measured by its progress toward a broad goal, reversing a downward cycle in the advancement of America's chip technology. When a country falls behind a technology's leading edge, many of the best minds go elsewhere, and the country falls further behind the leaders. But when a country is at the leading edge, it attracts the best minds from around the world, further accelerating its lead, an upward cycle. We were in a 30-year downward cycle in the U.S., Gelsinger says. We needed a bit of a shock to the industry, and that's what the CHIPS Act provided. That's a lot to achieve in the 5-year program authorized by the CHIPS Act, but 5 years may be just the beginning. When a country starts subsidizing a major industry, turning back abruptly becomes almost impossible. In February, Raimondo mentioned the possibility of a CHIPS II. Gelsinger says, I fully expect that we need a CHIPS II. 30 years of poor economic policy cannot be fixed in a 3 to 5 year CHIPS I program. Canceling incentives is especially hard when competition is intense. SIA's Neufer notes, after 5 years, our competitors around the world are not going to say, we're going to stop providing incentives ourselves. Regardless of its success, the global pressures that motivated the CHIPS Act show no signs of abating. For companies and their leaders in every industry, the importance of the CHIPS Act is the light it has shone on a world order increasingly dominated by competition through economics, trade, and technology. The winners will be those who confront that reality fastest and most fully. That article was titled Today Chips, Tomorrow Everything by Jeff Colvin. Our next article is titled The CEO Leading Korea's Google in Its Battle Against Big Tech. Choi Soo-yeon has led Naver through crisis and maintained its search engine lead over Google. Now she's aiming to outmaneuver the giants again in AI. By Nicholas Gordon. Internet firm Naver has earned its nickname Korea's Google by pulling off an improbable feat. It dominates South Korea's search market, having defended its turf from Google, the world's top search engine, whose revenue is 40 times as large as Naver's. As of September 2023, Naver controlled 59% of Korea's search market to Google's 31%. Naver is perhaps the only company in the world that has survived competition against Google and Amazon, says Choi Soo-yeon, Naver's CEO, since 2022. Naver is hardly a household name outside Korea, but it operates a sprawling portfolio that pits the $22 billion internet or in-market cap firm against other big tech giants on multiple fronts. It has a controlling stake in both Yahoo, Japan, the most popular website in Japan, according to Nielsen, and the Japanese messaging app Line, a WhatsApp rival, through a joint venture with SoftBank. It runs Korea's number two e-commerce service, behind Coupang. Amazon's platform ranks fourth. Naver's $1.2 billion purchase last year of Poshmark, the U.S.-based clothing resale site, expanded its retail reach. In the streaming wars era, Naver has amassed content platforms of its own. It owns Webtoon, which hosts mobile-friendly comic strips that are popular across Asia. Naver is reportedly planning a U.S. IPO for Webtoon later this year. Naver bought Wattpad, a Canada-based platform for user-submitted fiction, for $600 million in 2021. Naver also has a small but growing cloud computing business, a category in which Amazon, Google, and Microsoft reign supreme. And it's launched a series of AI projects to contend with the release of OpenAI's viral chatbot, ChatGPT. In recent quarters, Neighbor's many business lines have notched record revenues and operating profits, but Choi sees Neighbor's mission as extending beyond its own bottom line. Despite Neighbor's small size, she casts the firm as a counterpoint in a global tech scene in which power is concentrated among a gargantuan few. It's becoming a world where there are only one or two search companies and one or two commerce companies, Choi said in a recent wide-ranging interview, her first with the international press at Neighbor headquarters in Songnam, just outside Seoul. Choi gave her answers in Korean, which were later translated into English. Neighbor is a company that constantly fights against such a world and strives to preserve diversity, she says. Investors question whether Neighbor can go toe-to-toe with cash-rich rivals. Still, Choi's goal is ambitious, perhaps even noble, and belies the role she was appointed to fill, that of a caretaker CEO brought on to steady a company in turmoil. Choi, 42, was an unconventional pick to run the company. A Harvard-educated M&A lawyer, she joined Neighbor in 2019 as head of global business support to help lead the firm's expansion. 3 years later, the board named Choi as CEO to show it was prepared to overhaul its culture after a series of crises. In May 2021, a senior Neighbor developer died by suicide after accusing the company of fostering a toxic work culture. A labor union probe found he'd been bullied by executives for years. A later survey found bullying to be widespread at the company. In the aftermath, Neighbor said there were some acts of workplace harassment by some executives. Choi's predecessor as CEO, Han Song-suk, stepped down, as did Neighbor's COO, and Neighbor tapped Choi. At the time, she told shareholders her most urgent task was to recover Neighbor's corporate culture based on trust and autonomy. But a second tragedy struck early in Choi's tenure. In September 2022, another employee died by suicide while on maternity leave, local media reported. Months later, her family claimed she'd been mistreated at work. Neighbor said the employee hadn't filed reports of harassment. South Korea has the highest rate of suicide of all Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development countries, and South Koreans work 200 hours more per year than the global average. There was a lack of trust in the systems, leadership, and board, Choi says of Neighbor's previous culture. One big change Choi made was to reintroduce remote work, a rarity in post-COVID South Korea. The option gives employees the choice of what kind of working environment they can be most productive and create the most innovation in. The suicides were the biggest scandal to rock Neighbor in its 25-year history. Neighbor launched in 1999 when founder Lee Hai-jin turned an internal Samsung project into an independent company. By the mid-2000s, Neighbor had passed rivals like web portal Dom to dominate Korea's search market. Neighbor and fellow internet firm Kakao, founded by an ex-Neighbor executive, have made South Korea one of a handful of countries where homegrown search engines outperform U.S. search giants without government intervention. Neighbor got a head start on tailoring a search engine that met the tastes of the South Korean market, says Bok Young-soo, a Korea analyst at Bernstein Research. Neighbor hooked users early with its busy homepage that was heavy on icons, links, and animations. Google launched a bare-bones search engine in Korea in 2000, but it didn't catch on. Google updated its site to a feature-rich format 6 years later. Neighbor earned 9.6 trillion won, $7.41 billion, in revenue in 2023, a record. Search and e-commerce generated 37% and 26% of sales, respectively. It made $1.3 billion in operating profit, also a record. Yet shares are currently trading about 60% below a COVID-era high. Investors are concerned about slowing revenue from search, up 0.6% in 2023, plummeting revenue from display ads, down 10% last year, and the lack of a punchy, clear growth strategy, Sue says. Neighbor's lack of a punchy, clear growth strategy is especially worrisome in the AI age, when Naver faces U.S. companies that are investing billions in the technology. As U.S. giants dominate English-based AI, Naver may be able to establish an edge in systems based in Korean and other languages, Choi says. Naver has a chatbot, Clova X, and an AI-powered search engine, Q. Both are built on its Korean language large language model. Hyper Clova X, which outperforms OpenAI's GPT in Korean, recent studies say. Naver claims Hyper Clova X is trained on 6,500 times as much Korean data as GPT 3.0, which underpins OpenAI's ChatGPT. Naver is also partnering with Saudi Aramco on an Arabic language model. Choi is especially interested in what she calls sovereign AI, or a model that's tailored to an individual user. We focus on what companies and governments that want to use AI would want, and what needs big tech can't fulfill, she says. As AI becomes more common, each group will need an AI model that best understands its unique traits. Much like her rivals at Google and Microsoft, Choi is also grappling with how to integrate AI, with its penchant to hallucinate false information, into Naver's search product. People need accurate information through search, she says, though she hopes AI's tendency to make stuff up will become nearly negligible in the near future. At the same time, she also sees room for a traditional search engine with its list of links to choose from amid the generative AI revolution. Not all questions in the world have a single correct answer, she says. There is still a need for exploration. Naver's base in South Korea, a chip powerhouse, is an advantage in the AI race, especially its homegrown manufacturers that support the Korean language, Choi says. Naver's chip partners include Korea's Samsung and the U.S.'s Intel. It's not healthy to rely on just one company, Choi says. Is that a coded reference to NVIDIA? Yes, she says in English, with a smile. Just four of South Korea's top 100 firms by revenue had women CEOs last year, according to global headhunter Unico Search. Just 6% of executives at the companies were women. Choi, whose CEO contract expires in 2025, expresses some unease at often being a sole woman in business. Simply because I am a woman, there are expectations for me to demonstrate skills such as effective communication, adept conflict resolution, and the ability to nurture people. Korea's internet sector got a lot more diverse when Kakao appointed its first female CEO, Shina Chung, in March. I'm not alone anymore, Choi says. That article was titled "The CEO Leading Korea's Google in Its Battle Against Big Tech" by Nicholas Gordon. We will now conclude an article from last week's reading of Forbes and Fortune from the April 8th edition of Barron's magazine titled "Big Pharma Needs a Rethink. The Stocks Aren't Working" by Josh Nathan Kaziz. A trading strategy means paying close attention to the big patent expirations through the end of the decade. Unlike in most other developed economies, the U.S. doesn't restrict what companies can charge for medicines. In most cases, prices only come down once patents expire. Companies use various tactics to extend those periods, including filing dozens of patents to protect various aspects of a single drug. But eventually, exclusivity periods all come to an end. Studies suggest that the average time between a drug launch and its first copycat competitor is between 12 and 15 years. The patent cliff metaphor used to describe lost drug revenue isn't hyperbole. Once a generic drug enters the market, prices can drop more than 95%. Among big pharma companies, Merck faces the steepest patent cliff, with products that had combined sales of over $30 billion in 2023, set to go off patent through 2030. Most of that lost revenue is attributable to Keytruda, the cancer mega blockbuster, which was responsible for 42% of Merck's 2023 sales and is set to face a patent expiration in the U.S. in 2028. Bristol-Myers is number two, with drugs that brought more than $23 billion in 2023, set to go off-patent through 2030, including its blood thinner Eliquis and its cancer drug Opdivo. For Pfizer, drugs that brought in more than $17 billion in 2023 will go off-patent by 2030. At an investor conference in January, Merck CEO Robert Davis talked about his company's Keytruda situation as a hill, not a cliff. To be sure, Merck has a reasonable shot at slowing the decline in Keytruda revenue, in part because the company is testing a new version that can be injected under the skin that might fend off some competition from a wave of biosimilar versions of the drug. Other than R&D efforts, Big Pharma's other antidote to patent expirations has been deal-making. In December, Pfizer closed its big $43 billion acquisition of Seagen, a leader in the field of antibody-drug conjugates, which combine the tumor-targeting properties of cancer immunotherapies with the tumor-killing properties of chemotherapy. The technology seized the drug industry's attention last year when it became every company's must-have accessory, and Merck, AbbVie, and Johnson & Johnson all signed multi-billion dollar deals to secure ADCs of their own. In January of 2023, Pfizer told investors to expect full-year revenue of between $67 billion and $71 billion, and adjusted diluted earnings of between $3.25 and $3.45 per share. It didn't happen. In the end, Pfizer's 2023 revenue added up to $58.5 billion. Its adjusted diluted earnings were just $1.84 per share. Pfizer declined to make an executive available to speak for this story. In a conversation with Barron's in January, Bourla acknowledged that 2023 had been a disappointing year for the company. Pfizer shares went down because we missed our internal projections and our external projections, he said. We had a very bad year. Pfizer was particularly wrong about demand for its COVID-19 products, namely its Comirnaty vaccine and its Paxlovid antiviral. The company had once projected combined 2023 sales for the two medicines of $21.5 billion. They came in at less than $12.5 billion. The magnitude of the difference in where we've ended up has been so dramatic that it really equates to uncertainty, which has a way of eroding confidence of investors in management, says Goldman Sachs analyst Chris Shubutani. Making predictions about Comirnaty and Paxlovid in January was an unprecedented challenge. No one had ever managed the shift from a pandemic-era market where the U.S. government was purchasing all COVID-19 products to a commercial market where the products fell back on the standard mix of insurers, employers, and government payers. More worrisome for the company is the shakiness the year exposed in the company's base business and in its pipeline. Sales of Pfizer's new RSV vaccine lagged behind rival GSK's. While Pfizer cut revenue expectations for a new ulcerative colitis drug, its efforts to develop a new weight loss pill have not paid off. Pfizer notes that it had a record number of FDA approvals for new medicines and vaccines in 2023. Launches it expects will help offset the impact of the patent expirations through 2030. But recent history suggests that no one, including company executives, have a good fix on the drug market. A new wave of Medicare price rules makes the industry less predictable than ever. Investors should embrace that reality. The days of putting Big Pharma investments on autopilot are long gone. That article was titled, Big Pharma Needs a Rethink. The Stocks Aren't Working, by Josh Nathan Kaziz. Our next article, also from the April edition of Barron's magazine, is titled, Europe, Unlike the U.S., Seems Eager to Cut Rates, by Brian Swint. While Federal Reserve officials say they are in no rush to cut interest rates, central bankers in Europe seem eager to get the rate cutting started. there are good reasons for U.S. investors to pay attention. If European central banks cut rates sooner and more aggressively than the Fed, that could reinforce the dollar's strength. The dollar index, a measure of the dollar's value against the currencies of most of the U.S.'s key trading partners, has already gained 3.5% this year. A higher dollar diminishes the value of overseas sales of U.S. companies, though it could make Europe a cheaper destination for U.S. tourists. The Bank of England, which sets rates for the United Kingdom, and the European Central Bank, which sets policies for the 20 countries sharing the euro, including Germany and France, are currently expected to cut rates around the same time as the Fed. But there are increasing signs that Europe is itching to start sooner. For one, inflation rates are still falling quickly in the UK and the Eurozone, whereas in the US, the Fed's preferred inflation gauge suggests that price growth looks sticky. Second, some policymakers in Europe are becoming more vocal about pushing for earlier moves. And third, the economic outlook is much weaker across the pond, providing an extra incentive for central banks to lend support for growth. Fed Chairman Jerome Powell says he's in no hurry to cut interest rates. The Personal Consumption Expenditures Index, the Fed's preferred inflation metric, showed a 2.8% annual gain in March, in line with expectations and well above the Fed's 2% annual inflation target. Economists and investors expect the first Fed cut in June, although the risk seems skewed toward a longer wait. Compare those views to the latest remarks from Bank of England Governor Andrew Bailey, who told the Financial Times just after the March rate decision that progress on inflation means rate cuts are a possibility at every meeting henceforth, while the two most hawkish members of the rate-setting committee pushed back against Bailey's comments. They also took a dovish turn, voting to keep rates steady in March after having called for further hikes. With the UK's inflation rate dropping to 3.4% in February from 4% in January and forecast calling for it to fall to the 2% target this quarter, one BOE committee member is already voting for cuts. The UK economy is emerging from a recession. Economists still see the first rate cut as most likely in August, but markets are pricing in a chance of a cut at the May meeting. ECB President Christine Lagarde won't commit to a path of cuts, but has teed up June as a likely start date. Her colleague, Bank of France Governor François Villeroy de Gallo, has hinted at a cut as soon as the next meeting on April 11th. Eurozone inflation dropped to 2.4% in March from 2.6% in February. Last month, the Swiss National Bank surprised markets by cutting rates. It's the first major central bank to lower borrowing costs since the end of the COVID pandemic. Policymakers on both sides of the Atlantic have become more skeptical about their inflation forecasts. In January, Lagarde lambasted her economists for being too myopic in failing to account for the risks of, say, a pandemic or Russia invading Ukraine. The BOE, meanwhile, has commissioned former Fed chairman and Nobel Prize winner Ben Bernanke to write a report on how to improve its forecasting. It is due to be published this month. If officials don't trust forecasts for inflation, it could lead them to keep rates higher than otherwise, or worry that rates are too high, given the economic conditions. That gives more scope for central bank policies to diverge with greater consequences for markets. That article was titled Europe, Unlike the U.S., Seems Eager to Cut Rates by Brian Swint. Our next article is from the April 15th edition of Barron's Magazine. The title of this article, Back to the Future, What 1967 May Tell Us About What's Next, by Randall W. Forsyth. Another bad inflation report rocked markets this past week, sending economists scurrying to revise their forecasts again, eliminating or delaying anticipated interest rate cuts by the Federal Reserve. But rather than needing to be trimmed, the central bank's federal funds target is already arguably low relative to the economy's growth rate based on historical standards. Even after sharp increases in 2022-2023, the target range of 5.25% to 5.5% for the Fed's key policy rate is below nominal year-over-year growth in gross domestic product of 5.9%, a report from Piper Sandler's economics team led by Nancy Lazar points out. Nominal GDP is the economy's output measured in current dollars, as opposed to the more familiar real total, which is adjusted for inflation. As the nearby chart shows, the Fed's target rate for Fed funds fluctuates above and below nominal GDP. Below when policy is stimulative, above when policy is restrictive. The years after the financial crisis of 2008-2009 saw the Fed funds rate pinned near zero, as it was again after the COVID pandemic. Growth currently is being supported by legacy liquidity from the gusher pumped in by the Fed in reaction to the pandemic, which boosted consumers' real net worth. Plus, Piper Sandler points to a federal budget deficit running at an egregiously high 7% of GDP. But looking at periods analogous to the present, those rare instances of a soft landing for the U.S. economy, with inflation abating without serious harm to growth or employment, the Fed funds rate was higher than nominal GDP twice, in 1985 and 1995, notes Piper Sandler. The exception, 1967. That year might be remembered for the summer of love, or less fondly, urban riots and spreading protests against the Vietnam War. The Six-Day War, which resulted in Israel gaining control of the Gaza Strip with other territories, also occurred in 1967. The contours of the U.S. economy looked familiar. The unemployment rate was under 4%. A warning of the labor market was tight, Piper Sandler points out, while inflation ran just over 3%. The robust conditions followed aggressive Fed easing the year before, with a Fed funds rate slashed by 2 percentage points. That was in reaction to a credit crunch that hit banks and thrift institutions in 1966, when short-term rates rose above then-regulated rate ceilings. This history seemed to be a prologue to the run on Silicon Valley Bank and other lenders last year. In any case, the stock market loved 1967's soft landing backdrop, soaring 50% from late 1966 to early 1968, notes Piper Sandler. If the economy is again enjoying a soft landing, not the firm's base case, it notes, it most resembles the 1967 episode, which is consistent with the big rally in the S&P 500 index of 26% from the late October low, the team adds. But what followed the 60s go-go stock rally was a doubling in inflation to over 6%, followed by the 1969-1970 recession that sharply lifted unemployment without a reduction in inflation. The parallel may also hold for today's tight labor market and bond yields, suspecting an inflation problem down the road, Piper Sandler writes. This was also clearly on the mind of J.P. Morgan Chase CEO Jamie Dimon in his annual letter. While indicators today are good, looking ahead, he warned, there seems to be a large number of persistent inflationary pressures which may likely continue. All of the following factors appear to be inflationary: ongoing fiscal spending, remilitarization of the world, restructuring of global trade, capital needs of the new green economy, and possibly higher energy costs in the future. Even though there currently is an oversupply of gas and plentiful spare capacity in oil due to a lack of needed investment in the energy infrastructure. We will conclude that article titled Back to the Future, What 1967 May Tell Us About What's Next, by Randall W. Forsyth, in next week's reading of Forbes and Fortune. That's all the time we have for this week's Forbes and Fortune. I'm John Gussich for the Virginia Voice. This program is also available on demand at www.virginiavoice.org.